Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today one of our most frequent guests. His name is Ammon Shay. You might recall we had him on the program a couple years ago for his book, Reading the OED. His new book is The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads. Welcome back, Ammon.
Hi, well, thanks for having me.
The Phone Book, Ammon, was this like so obvious that it just like fell in your lap? I mean, how did you come up with this idea?
You know, it wasn't quite as obvious as it might seem, I guess. You know, what I was doing at first is after I wrote this book about reading the dictionary, I really became interested in other kinds of reference books or other kinds of books that everybody owns but nobody reads, you know, sales catalogs, atlases, things like that. And so I began looking into these things, and what I discovered pretty quickly is that all these other books have been somewhat examined, all these other kinds of books like atlases and sales catalogs and whatnot, but that nobody has ever really looked into the phone book. Nobody's ever written a book about it, and there have been no doctoral dissertations written about the telephone book. Now, you know, some people might see that and think, well, there's probably a very logical reason for this this absence of writing about it. But somebody like me sees that and thinks, you know, the exact opposite. I think, you know, I'd really like to write a book about that. So that's what kind of drew me into it in the first place.
So the phone book, you went back and tried to find a copy of the phone book that you remembered. You mentioned in the book that your parents were, I think you called them Luddites. They didn't have a phone until the 1970s?
Yeah, they didn't. They didn't have a telephone. And the only reason they got one was, I think, 1972. They got one because I was a very sickly child, and they thought they needed one in case I felt desperately ill in the middle of the night. But up until that point, they just didn't have a telephone. They weren't interested in people calling them. And even when they did get a telephone, they had it under my brother's name, just so that people couldn't find them in the telephone book.
That's ahead of their time.
Yeah, they were.
So you went out and you found a copy of a late 1970s, was it a Manhattan phone directory?
Yeah, I went out and I picked up copies of the White Pages and the Yellow Pages from the New York City of my childhood, basically. And I went for the 1979-1980, which would be about the time that I was 9 or 10 years old, because I think that age is, as I remember it, the age at which people kind of get a sense of the world outside their immediate home. And I was curious, you know, everybody thinks of the telephone book and most reference books as being so unemotional. And in a sense, they really are. But I wanted to know if there was anything of any sort of emotion within it. And what I discovered is that when you look through, at least for me, the telephone book, both the Yellow Pages and the White, but especially the Yellow Pages, when you look through these telephone books from your childhood, they're so comprehensive, they leave nothing out, that they have this remarkable ability to kind of remember things for you and to be evocative on their own. They draw out these memories that, for whatever reason, have fallen by the wayside in my own brain. They're not concerned with being, you know, overtly emotional. They're not concerned with being literary, and because of this, they have such a singular goal, which is just to write down everything that occurred, everything that existed in this time and place, you know, all the businesses and all the people. And they do this so well that they remember things that I could never remember, and it kind of acts as this this spur to your memory. And once you remember this store, that makes you think of that bakery that your parents used to bring you to, and that makes you think of that toy store that closed in 1978 or something like that. And it becomes this wonderful imaginative exercise in going through your own history.
And they've made billions of phone books, and yet it's probably not that easy to find that particular phone book that's going to take you down your own personal memory lane.
You can look on eBay for your own personal childhood telephone book, but they are very, very hard to find. You know, and this is, again, one of the problems with things like the telephone book is that we so often overlook the quotidian. We ignore the things that are every day in life. And then, you know, a relatively brief period of time goes by, and suddenly these things that were so commonplace can be very hard to find. The telephone book itself, it's never been made to last. It's never been You know, there was never a limited edition telephone book that was, you know, or there had been, but only for like, you know, inside the telephone companies. But nobody ever, you know, received, no telephone customers received, you know, telephone books on nice paper, paper that was meant to last more than a few years. And the telephone companies themselves always asked their customers to throw away or destroy the telephone books once they became outdated. And so it's very difficult to find ones that are old. And there was one that sold, one of the earliest ones, and it's not the very first, but there was one from late 1878, one of the first telephone books ever printed, that some book collector had, that he auctioned off at Christie's about a year and a half or so ago, and that just sold for about $170,000.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, so if you find one from 1878, hold on to it.
You go back to the origins of the phone book, and I was particularly intrigued by the Chinatown, San Francisco phone exchange and the phone book out there.
It's a wonderful telephone book. And well, in San Francisco, they had the original Chinatown. It was the first Chinatown in a major United States city, I think. And within the San Francisco Chinatown, they had their own telephone exchange that was not connected to the main board of the San Francisco telephone system. And because of this, they had their own telephone book, which was entirely lettered by hand. And it was all written in Chinese lettering. And at the time, they didn't have a means of doing this. They didn't have a printer for this. So they would hire a Chinese calligrapher. And for most of the several decades that it existed, it was a man named Sam Wong. He would use very traditional calligraphic techniques, and he would use cuttlefish ink that came from the cuttlefish found in Monterey Bay, and he used a Chinese brush and sponge. And he would letter all 2,500 or 3,000 names by hand. And then they would send it to a printer who would, you know, mimeograph or reproduce this. And there are very, very few of these left. They would only print 2,000 or 3,000 every year. But it's kind of wonderful that there was existing within our telephone system a kind of subsystem that was all in Chinese.
And it needs to be pointed out that this guy went to all this trouble with this phone book, and there weren't any phone numbers.
Right. And, you know, it's great. You know, well, the Chinese telephone operators, or the operators in the Chinatown telephone system, it was, at the time, and this is early 20th century, it was considered a kind of prestigious job. And in some cases, it was passed down not just from one generation to the next, but, you know, three or four generations. And the operators knew all the telephone numbers. So you would call up and say you wanted to speak to, and you would just give the name of somebody, whoever it was you wanted to speak to. And the operators, when they first started working at this exchange, they typically spent the first 3 or 4 weeks just memorizing. They sent around memorized telephone numbers. And so most of them knew 3,000 telephone numbers just off the top of their head. And so you would call up and you'd say, I want to speak to whatever, Sam Wong, and they just knew his telephone number, and they would connect you to him through the board. And then they also would memorize the locations most frequently used by people who didn't even have telephones, who lived in Chinatown. So if you wanted to speak to somebody who was known to hang out, you know, at this particular restaurant, you would call up and say you want to speak to this guy, and the operator you got would know the telephone numbers that are likely to be near where this person is probably going to be at that time of the day. So it was a little bit of a different kind of telephone system than we have today.
Yeah, I think it's called superior customer service.
Right, something like that.
We're talking to Ammon Shea. The book is The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads. A few people do read it. In fact, you make the point that there's some people who memorize the darn thing.
Right. Well, you know, one of the people who used to really read the telephone book was a man named, I think, Kim Peek, who was the character that Rain Man, and that Dustin Hoffman character that movie was based on. He would he read all kinds of reference materials. You know, I don't know that he was actually autistic, but he had some, you know, some leanings in that direction. He was definitely some kind of savant. He was, you know, a wonderful, wonderful mind for a lot of things. He could remember things, you know, with spectacular accuracy. What I think was enchanting was he didn't just read the telephone book, but he carried a notebook around with him so that he would write down the favorite numbers that he came across. Seems like a kind of synesthesia, you know, people have a different reaction to numbers sometimes than most of us. And so he just had numbers that he thought had particular character or flavor, and he would write them down. There was a famous basketball player named Jerry Lucas, who was part of the 1973 New York Knicks championship team, and he's a great basketball player. He was, I think, in the NBA Hall of Fame. After he retired, he became a memory expert, but he was always a memory freak, you could say, and phenomenally good at it. He would take the Manhattan White Pages with him on the road when the Knicks would travel, and he just used it as practice. He would sit there on the plane and just he would spend the three-hour flight memorizing a page or two of the telephone numbers in the Manhattan White Pages.
If I'm not mistaken, I think he went to college just down the road from here at Ohio State. I'm pretty sure that Jerry Lucas, I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure he went to Ohio State.
That does sound familiar.
That's amazing. This guy was a star basketball player who memorized phone books.
Well, you know, and there is a kind of myth that has sprung up about Jerry Lucas, which he himself never, I think, said, which is that he memorized the entire telephone book. And I think the reason why this myth has been so thoroughly propagated is, even though it's completely insane, I mean, there are, you know, a million names in the Manhattan telephone book, saying he memorized all of them is saying he memorized 7 million digits, essentially. The reason that it's so easy for people to believe that is because, well, the amount of numbers that he actually did memorize, which I think he said at one point it was about 30,000 telephone numbers, which is to say 210,000 digits. Once you get past the first several hundred thousand digits in terms of memorization, I don't think there's that much difference to people between 200,000 and 7 million. They just seem completely absurd and impossible. So I don't believe that Jerry Lucas ever memorized the entire telephone book, but as far as most people are concerned, he might as well have, because what he was able to do with it was it seemed so inhuman in a way.
My guest is Ammon Shea. We're talking about the phone book, and you address a number of legends, and one that I always believed was that during those senatorial filibusters, that when they were trying to filibuster for hours and hours and hours, that they supposedly read the phone book. Well, you actually went back and reread the congressional record for Strom Thurmond's 24-hour speech back in the early 50s.
Yeah, which I have to say, I do not recommend this to anybody, and this is coming from a man who reads dictionaries and the occasional telephone book and sales catalogs. I can absolutely say I have never read anything as boring as Strom Thurmond's 25-hour and 17-minute speech. Reading about it is kind of interesting. Thurmond was a really, I think, in many ways, an unpleasant character, but you do have to admire him in some ways. He went and took a long, long sauna. He was terribly dehydrated before he gave the speech, just so that he could drink without having to go to the bathroom. And filibusters in those days were different than they are today. You actually had to stand there and talk nonstop. And he talked for 25 hours and 17 minutes, I think it was. It's the record. Nobody's beat that since, or, you know, certainly before. And so it was commonly said that he spent some portion of that time reading the telephone book, and it's just not true. He read lots of things. I think he read the voting laws of most states. He read the enormous portions of the Constitution and things like that, but he did not read the telephone book at any point.
I'd be very surprised if there was anyone there who can claim they heard everything that he said.
I very much doubt that there was. I'm sure everybody must have fallen asleep to a certain extent.
Well, he talked in this monotone the whole time, didn't he?
Yeah, that's the New York Times reported it. He just stood there, and he was speaking kind of listlessly. You know, I mean, if you're going to speak for 25 hours, your chances are you're not going to be engaging in kind of great rhetorical flourishes. However, I think the exception to that was Huey Long was another one who gave a really long filibuster. I think it was 17 or 18 hours, which is to say not nearly as long as Strom Thurmond, but considerably longer than most of us would typically like to speak. And Huey Long was also reputed in his filibuster. This is when he was senator of Louisiana. He was reputed to have read the telephone book. And I read his filibuster as well, and although there is no telephone book reading in there, it's very funny, and Huey Long was a very funny man, whatever his other many, many flaws were. And he gave a number of recipes for things, and one of them was so charming. It was his recipe for a Roquefort cheese salad dressing. I reprinted it in the book because I thought it was kind of a sin that Huey Long's Roquefort cheese salad dressing recipe should only exist in the Congressional Record, because nobody ever reads the Congressional Record.
And by a bizarre coincidence, last night I read his recipe in your book, and I also was looking at the new New York Times cookbook, and there's a 1935 recipe from Huey Long in there. I was astonished.
Really? Is it his pot liquor?
It's for a drink, some kind of a gin fizz.
Well, Huey Long is making a culinary comeback, what can we say?
I couldn't believe it, because I read that, and then I read your book, and I'm like, this is too weird. Huey Long turns up with a recipe in two books in a row.
Well, you know, in his filibuster, he did give three different recipes. One was for pot liquor, and I forget what the other one was, and then there was the one for his salad dressing. I didn't know that he had recipes for gin fizzes or things like that, though it doesn't really surprise me. He seems like the kind of guy who would, hand out recipes, like things like that, in bon mots when he's giving press conferences or speaking to reporters all over.
Well, he was in New York City, and he actually flew up a bartender from New Orleans to make this drink for the reporters assembled there.
Now, I'm sure he did it on the government payroll.
I'm sure he did. You encountered a number of telephone book collectors. These are an odd group, aren't they?
Yeah, there are not that many telephone book collectors out there, but they do exist. And, you know, I mean, there are people who collect just about everything out there. But in particular, there's a fellow named Charles Eric Gordon, who I met in New York City. He works as an investigative counsel. He's a lawyer who essentially tracks people down. And so I think what he really has done is kind of combined his passion for collecting telephone books, and he really figured out a kind of nifty way to make a living from it as well. And I've seen him actually use them to track people through several decades of, you know, moving throughout the city. And it's fairly remarkable the degree of accuracy with which he can trace people's movements over the decades. And it also, I think, speaks to the this notion that every once in a while you hear people say these ridiculous things like, oh, everything you need is on the Internet, or you can find anyone on the Internet. And it's really just not at all true. And You can't find, for instance, where somebody lived in 1986 on 3rd Avenue and 21st Street on the Internet. You know, if you own New York City telephone books over the last 50 years, you have a much better chance of being able to do that. So there are not that many people who need to be able to do what he does, but it's still, to me, very interesting that he's able to put them to such a very specific and effective use.
And here I thought you could find everything on Google. Our guest is Ammon Shay. His new book is The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads. And we can't talk about phone books without talking about the people that like to rip them in half. And you do quite a bit of coverage of this phenomenon.
Yeah, well, you know, people have been ripping telephone books in half ever since telephone books were large enough for it to be considered impressive, which is to say the early 20th century. And, you know, in the 19-teens, 1920s, I think is when it really first became popular, and there were not a lot of, you know, telephone book rippers that you find. There were women who ripped telephone books. I came across accounts of I think it was a 17-year-old woman in Brooklyn, a young woman or girl named Verve Simelvart, who would rip telephone books. There was Jean Rhodes, was a professional strong woman who used to tour with Bob Hope, would rip telephone books in half.
She's the one that threw him to the ground.
Yeah, she's the one, and she picked him up when they were on tour and dropped him on his head on a concrete floor. And after that, they kind of, I think their professional relationship maybe cooled a little bit after she dropped him on his head. But then there were a lot of men who have ripped telephone books in half. And my personal favorite, I think, is the current, although deceased, world record holder, which is a man named Ed Sharon, who, over the course of his lifetime, it's estimated that he ripped about 65,000 telephone books in half, because he used to practice ripping them, and he would just wake up in the morning and he would spend some time ripping, and he would rip 100 a day. And he set the world record, and I think it was 2005, where he ripped 56 copies of the Portland, Oregon White Pages in 3 minutes.
Wow.
And these are not small telephone books. These are, you know, they're more than 1,000 pages each. And he used it as part of his kind of work. He was an evangelical preacher, and he would go speak to youth groups and prisoners and things like that. And he had this kind of evangelical spiel that he would give. So I'm sure he wouldn't call it a spiel, but it was very dramatic, and he would, you know, kind of work his way up to this crescendo, talking about all the different levels of sin and how you could avoid each one, how you could cast out the demon of, you know, drunkenness and the demon of this and the demon of that. And every time he talked about each one, he would rip a telephone book in half for emphasis. And so it was kind of, I don't know if you ever saw that great old Victor Borges skit where he does, you know, he's talking about punctuation, and he's saying about, you know, how wouldn't it be great if instead of using commas in speech, we made funny noises like, or, and it's a beautiful way of kind of, you know, looking at the language. Well, this guy basically did the same thing. He basically would punctuate his speech with ripping telephone books in half. So in terms of visiting death and destruction upon the telephone book, I think this guy is definitely the absolute record holder of all time. And again, 56 telephone books ripped in half. He was 70 years old when he did this. And there are all these different ways of ripping telephone books in half. And I think that the way that he used was the most honest, which was that he just had monstrously strong hands and practiced it.
What's the most amazing thing you discovered in your research?
I think it's my personal favorite, and I think most interesting, is the fact that in large part the telephone and the telephone book is responsible for the fact that we say hello to each other. And one of the books that I mentioned earlier, which is it was a book from 1878, the one that sold at auction for that huge sum of money. In the introduction to that, there are directions, because people didn't really understand how to use the telephone when it first came out. It was this incredibly foreign form of technology. And when people first tried to use the telephone, they would become embarrassed, they would yell, they would stutter, they would just repeat themselves. And it seems odd to think of it now, but it's not so odd at the time. They didn't even know how to start a conversation or how to finish it. And so this telephone book of 1878 gave instructions of what you should do, not just how to work the telephone, which took about a page or a page and a half of instructions, but then once you get somebody on the line, what is the proper way to address them? And they said, you should say hello. Don't say, do I have you, or are you there, or anything like that. Just say hello. And up to this point, hello existed as a word in English, but it was not generally used as a conversation starter. Hello was typically used as in, hello, what have we here? Or, hello, that's a funny thing to find in my ear. It was more of an exclamatory remark. And thanks to the telephone and the instructions in the telephone book, it soon came to be used as the way in which we greet people. Now, Alexander Graham Bell,
ahoy!
Right, he wanted people to say ahoy, ahoy, which was a miserable failure. The only person, as far as I can tell, who that stuck with, oddly enough, is I'm told that Mr. Burns on The Simpsons answers the telephone with ahoy, ahoy.
Oh, I think
so
you're right.
He's apparently a fan of Alexander Graham Bell, but nobody else seems to have kind of held on to that. So that's the way in which the telephone and the telephone book have kind of infiltrated themselves into our daily existence in a way, and it's not something that's generally paid attention to.
Ammon Shea is our guest, and his new book is The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads. It was just published by Perigee. You know, I think about you every time we've had a long drought and it rains. I always think about you, because you taught me that word, petrichor.
Uh-huh. That's right, the smell of rain when it first begins to fall on the ground after a drought.
That word has really stuck with me.
Yeah, that's one of the words that sticks with most people, I think, because it so beautifully describes a thing which everybody knows, but we never knew that there was a word for.
Are you still doing dictionary work?
I am. Well, actually, I work for Oxford University Press now as a consultant of sorts. And I've started reading other kind of non-narrative texts, so to speak. I just got a copy of this wonderful old, it was a news digest sort of, called Keesing's Contemporary Archives, which was a UK company that used to, every week, they would do a kind of a roundup of the world's news taken from 1,000 different sources around the world. perhaps unsurprisingly, libraries are getting rid of all their old sets of keys in contemporary archives because they take up a lot of room. And so I just found a great 49-volume set that, you know, fell out of somebody's library somewhere. It's, you know, weekly news reports from 1931 to 2003, and so that's how I'm passing my time now, is reading about little bits of old news.
How do they smell?
They smell pretty good.
Mm. I know you're into books and the scent of a book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think anybody who loves books has some memory of a smell of a particular book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a big part of what makes them books.
And you make the point that that's a big part about what makes a telephone book is because it's a book.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how many things go into making books. I mean, if it were just the words, then everybody would be fine reading on a computer. But it's not just the words. It's the associations, I think, that we make with books. So it's the smell of the paper. It's the weight of the book. It's the act of turning the page. And in some cases, it's the kind of, you know, just gently variegated colors on the page. For instance, you know, when I do look at things online, I find that it's much more interesting to me to read PDFs that reproduce the color of the page than it is just to read black and white text on a computer. There's a site, Internet Archive, which reproduces a lot of old books, and they have a lot of old telephone books and stuff, but old books of every kind. And what's nice is that they give you a choice of how you want to access these reproductions, and you can reproduce them as essentially color photographs, and it's a much more interesting way of looking at a book online than just the black and white text on a computer screen.
I'm with you. I like holding the book in my hand and maybe even sniffing it a little bit.
You can admit it.
I admit it. Ammon, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me once again.
My guest has been Ammon Shea. His new book is The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads. And Ammon was on the program a couple years ago because he read the entire Oxford English Dictionary, and he wrote about that too, that experience. It's called Reading the OED, and I would suggest that you pick that one up as well if you're looking for a fascinating journey through the world of words. Ammon took that trip and shared it with us on this program and with readers throughout the world. Thanks again, Ammon.
Okay, thank you, Vic.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. Tune into The Book Nook next week when my guest will be Bill Felker. His voice is familiar to many WYSO listeners. Bill is the creator of Poor Will's Almanac, and you hear it on WYSO every week. He also puts out a published almanac. Poor Will's Almanac for 2011 has just come out, and we're going to be talking to Bill about how he got into the almanac business and how he creates them and what they're all about. That's The Book Nook with Bill Felker. Next week, right here on WYSO, Poor Will's Almanac for 2011. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.